Welcome to the show. We'd like you all to know we're very, very thankful that you came, that you're here. We can leave you feeling numb now that we've just begun. So open up those big old hearts and open up your ears. There's a special delivery for all you special freaks and norms and nerds. There's a special delivery of stuff that you'll be happy that you heard. Cool. Thank you for coming, everybody. I know.
Okay. I'm going to do first
a song by the Jarmels. They're a doo-wop group from, I don't know, the 50s or something. It's called A Little Bit of Soap. A little bit of soap won't wash away lipstick from my face, but a little bit of soap will never erase the pain in my heart, my eyes, as I go through the lonely years. A little bit of soap will never wash away my tears. A little bit of soap will wash away powder from my chin. A little bit of soap will never begin. Take away the pain in my eyes as I go through the lonely years. A little bit of soap will never wash away my tears. Oh, have you heard? When love begins to die, it can leave someone to cry night and day. And like a bird, you left the robin's nest, just like all the rest, you flew away. A little bit of soul will wash away your perfume eventually. A little bit of soul will never wash away the memory of your name in the night as I go through the lonely years. A little bit of soul will never wash away my tears.
Cool.
Okay, next song is a Ramones song from the record Road to Ruin. Sometimes I think of a lot of stuff to say about all the songs in the show, but not this week.
Whiskey bottles, movie on TV, man.
just me, questioningly.
Time for two?
Yeah.
Cool. Two more songs. This one is my song. It is about I don't know, I guess I've been playing music for a while, and there's some people that I did that with who became wildly successful, and some people who decided that music wasn't something that they wanted to do anymore. And there's a lot of people sort of in the middle, you know, doing their thing. This song is maybe about the solidarity that I feel with those people. Going to talk to Duncan Cooper, and then after that, Poppies. Okay, this is a country classic called The Gambler, written by Don Schlitz. his name. And popularized by, what, Kenny Rogers.
Summer's evening, on a train bound to nowhere, I met up with a gambler. We were both too tired to sleep, so we took turns of staring out the window at the darkness. The boredom overcame us, and he commenced to speak. He said, "Son, I made a life out of reading people's faces, knowing what their cards were by the way they held their eyes. If you don't mind me saying, I can see you're out of aces. For a taste of your whiskey, I'll give you some advice. Because every game." So I handed him my bottle, and he drank down my last swallow. Then he bummed a cigarette, and then he bummed a light. The night grew deathly quiet, his face lost all expression. Said, "If you're gonna play the game, kid, you gotta learn to play it right. Because every gambler knows that the secret to surviving, knowing what to throw away and knowing what to keep. Cause every hand's a winner, just like every hand's a loser. The best that you can hope for is to die in your sleep. You got to know when to hold on, know when to fold on, know when to walk away, know when to run. And you never count your money while you're sitting at table. Be time enough for counting when the dealing is done." And when the gambler finished speaking, he turned back to the window, crushed out a cigarette, faded off to sleep. Somewhere's in the darkness, the gambler, he broke even. And in his final words I found an ace that I could keep. You gotta know when to hold on, know when to fold on, know when to walk away, know when to run. You never count your money while you're sitting at the table. Time enough for counting when the dealing is done. There'll be time enough for counting when the dealing is done.
Thanks.
Yeah, I love that new song, even though I've heard it for like a year and a half now.
Thank you.
The thing about that song it always reminds me of is Times Square, which is like the most calming place for me in New York.
Yes, you told me that. I've always found it to be very odd.
Yeah, I really like how when you're there, it just forces you to remember that nobody gives a shit about anything you give a shit about.
Yeah, right. We've talked about this. This is how like the ocean makes me feel or something. But you like Times Square.
I hate the ocean. To me, the ocean is nothing but like a big fish toilet. I don't like it. It's gross.
Okay.
So when we first started working together, there was a post about you in the Fader that overlapped with Duncan's time there.
Okay.
And there's like this weird feeling when somebody gets like a random out of nowhere post like that, where you're like, oh man, shit is like working out for me. This is like going great.
Little did you know.
Yeah, that was 4 years ago. We're still, there's like a dozen and a half people here.
Yeah.
Shit's looking up, man.
Yeah, totally.
our guest is Duncan Cooper. He's the Formator editor-in-chief. Was that the title? Yeah. Okay, cool. Editor-in-chief of The Fader. It's okay. Fired? Is fired the right term or let go? Okay, well, he was fired from the Fader last winter, and we're going to talk about that. Duncan, you want to come up on stage? For those listening who don't really know, what's an editor-in-chief do?
So at a place like the Fader, which has a print publication, I oversaw the print publication, along with the 24/7 website, along with the social media team and the news team that blogged, and in some way the video team as well. And also was sort of the conduit for the rest of the company, the creative agency that's also owned by the owners, the sales and advertising team. I kind of translated what the editorial properties were doing for advertisers so that they could understand and how to represent what we were doing well.
That's a lot of shit.
Yeah, it was a lot.
So who replaced you?
Nobody.
Oh, wow. That you would think...
Irreplaceable.
You would think that's a bad idea for an editorial media outlet to not have an editor.
Yeah. There's a lot of ways of trying to be a new media company these days, and you know,
is it working for anyone, do you think?
I don't know, I don't work there anymore.
Well, in general, just as somebody who I'm assuming spends most of your life on the internet or sleeping.
Yeah.
Where's it working?
I think that like the big destabilization that's been happening over the past year or so among professional music media has been really good for Pitchfork. I think that me and most people I know who've been fired or laid off from places have Pitchfork bylines.
Wait, sorry to interrupt. What percentage of people you know work in media have been fired or laid off from places?
Oh, that's it. I mean, it's a lot. But you know what is another thing, too, is a lot of people quit on their own accord because they can read the room and they can see that the people in charge are not looking out for their best interest, I might say.
Yeah, I mean, that's also like getting on a lifeboat off the Titanic, though, isn't it?
Wait, what do you mean?
Like, when you say they're reading the room and then they quit, isn't it the same situation, which they're in a thing that isn't working?
Well, I will say this. I mean,
they're going to have to get off one way or another.
They're going to have to get off, but I do know a lot of people who I think were... I would say maybe some of the smartest or most capable people within media in general have successfully switched sides, quote unquote, to either get jobs at record labels or streaming or general tech companies that exist. Like, that's still a pathway that can work for people for the moment. And so I don't know if I would say it if it's a lifeboat so much as like there happened to be like a second Titanic that they could get on.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You made it better.
Yeah, thank you.
Going back, how did you get started there?
It was actually very, you know, cute. I think so. I was living in outside of Philadelphia after graduating from college. I couldn't get a creative job in Philadelphia. I was working as a bank teller. So I applied and was accepted to grad school for media studies in New York. And I sent an email more or less after I was accepted to Matthew Schnipper, who was then an editor at the Fader and had been soliciting interns. And I sent him a sweet email, which was like, oh, isn't this beautiful? You're looking for interns and I'm moving to New York. Like, maybe I could be an intern at the Fader.
What was the website like then?
At the time, so I want to say this was 2010. The Fader was a music magazine that had been existing for at least a decade at this point. I think about that long. And this was a time social media was beginning to exist. Blogging and as a professional class was beginning to exist. And so I was ultimately hired at Fader in 2010 as what I believe was the first person for whom track blogging was what my job was. The people who ran the website at that point were editors of the print magazine who like blogged when they weren't making the magazine. And I believe that I was the first person who was hired for a Monday to Friday. You blog.
I love that detail that they had a blog, but it was just a thing that the people in charge of the magazine had to do in their downtime. Like, they clearly know that it's a thing that they have to do, but they both put a lot of importance by making the important people do it, but no importance in it in that it's just like whenever you can.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know how normal that was at the time. Like, there definitely were, before me, there were many really successful people who were bloggers, and that's what they did. For websites like XXL in particular, was like a famous hub for like early rap bloggers who got paid. I don't know how much. But yeah, people kind of saw something was happening, I guess, and that there was money in it. Like,
where was there money in it?
I don't know. But I think that there was... but I mean to say...
Was there? Isn't that what we're learning?
Well, I mean, there's like...
there wasn't?
There's like a thing that, you know... definitely like display ads were a thing that people could sell in 2010. And for a long time, I mean, until very... I mean, they still are sold. There still are display ads on every website that exists. And I think that... They saw that there was a business opportunity in blogging as just blogging. And then that transitioned to video as just video. And then maybe transitioned to social as just social. Maybe. And then there's like another thing that might come next after words, social and video. I don't know what. Well, I'll tell you what it is. It's podcasting.
Oh, no, it is not. That is definitely.
Do you make a lot of money doing this?
No, I lose money doing this. The sad thing about this show is that it costs me $15 a month to make. I still lose money doing this.
Exactly.
What's the thing you're selling though?
Who?
You formerly as editor in chief of the Fader. Like when you're selling ads, what is the specific thing you are selling? Like why is anyone giving you money?
I won't speak for just that publication in particular. I think like music publications are selling users of tech platforms primarily right now. Primarily music media exists in the minds of advertisers, seemingly to funnel people into one streaming platform or another.
What was it in 2010?
I guess like to shoes and other lifestyle products because streaming didn't exist.
When did the switchover happen?
That's a good question. I don't know. I couldn't tell you. I'd get it wrong. But at some point, obviously, like, you know, obviously at some point people stopped. At some point, streaming became the main way that most people got music. And I don't know when the tipping point was, but it was when you are more likely to have a subscription to Spotify or Apple than not. That was a time.
So when you say that they're selling users to platforms, how is that happening in practice now?
Oh, I don't know if I'd want to, I don't mean to say there's a conspiracy or anything other than that. That's just where like, go to a music website every day for a week and mark down what the ads are for, and you will see ads for Spotify and Apple Music.
Do you think people go to music websites, or do they go to specific pieces of content made by these websites through another platform?
Yeah, that's definitely how it works. People don't go to home pages by and large. Like, for probably any music publication, maybe 1 out of 50 clicks is to their homepage.
Are you serious?
Maybe. Damn. I mean, maybe if you're like, have a great homepage, it's better. Maybe it's 1 out of 20 or something like that. But almost everyone is clicking a direct link to a track or a video or a review or an opinion piece or whatever it is. Cover story.
What did you like about? I mean, you had that job for 8 years.
Yeah, I had it for a long time. And I think it was beautiful that you mentioned, like, as I was watching the musical stylings of Dougie Poole, who I have love his music for a long time. What motivated me from when I began as a tracks blogger to being the editor in chief was that I, in my personal assessment of music media, felt that there was a class of musicians and general, like, group of, a lot of time it was people who you might call lifers, or it's maybe experimental artists who haven't, like, broken through to like the bigger places than somewhere like the Fader. For me, it was absolutely about validating the art of people who weren't being validated other places. Up until, you know, the last thing that I published there was a short profile of one of my favorite bands of all time, State Champion, who, I mean, a friend of mine said recently, like, if they had existed 10 years ago, they'd be as big as Wilco or Drive By Truckers. They exist now, and so, like, nobody cares. I think that there's a small number of people who do care about small bands or whatever, and that was what mattered to me.
You writing about State Champion in 2018, aside from the fact that, like, tastes have changed since 2010,
yeah,
does a platform like the Fader, does that move the needle for a band that's that small?
I've heard that for some genres it does move the needle. People in country music told me that a placement on a place like Fader was really important for them for getting, like, access to new audiences. But I think that across the board, things that used to be the bread and butter of, I mean, track blogging as a practice, like, doesn't move the needle for almost anyone anywhere, I don't think.
But that wasn't always the case. That's like a new-ish thing.
Yeah, I mean, people always get signed off of blog posts, whatever the website is. If you're at a certain, like, level of cachet, record labels start to notice you, and agents start to notice you, and A&Rs start to notice you. That can materially affect an artist's life, but it's certainly not most people who are featured on semi-prominent music blogs. Most people who are featured are not probably impacted positively. Besides, what is a not insignificant psychological boost that some people feel about getting good press?
So you're managing artists now.
Yeah, with my partner. So my partner, Jen Cheney, already had a few artists, and a couple of lovely things worked out. And so now the two of us are working together on four people. And we also do press as well.
What's managing an artist?
So it's like,
please tell me. I have no idea how to do this job. I'm making no money.
Yeah.
Don't laugh at that.
I mean, basically, you know, in a nutshell, it's trying to get money from people, trying to do all the business for them. So, yeah, I see you, like, knocking your head.
Yeah. Ask for the money.
Yeah, I think it's like,
shit.
I mean, trying to make sure that they're doing creatively what they need to do so that they can either get a deal with a record label or get a deal with, like, a VC funded publishing startup or.
Well, I think you beat me to the punch, but I was about to ask, where is the money?
I think, you know, someone, I can't remember, some powerful music person last year correctly identified publishing as an inefficient market within music. I think that is where money is being made.
What part of working in media do you think prepared you to manage artists?
I think, I mean, I was thinking about this earlier today. There's most things that I don't miss at all, but I do occasionally feel very like impotent and angry when an artist that I love is getting no coverage anywhere. This advice came from a friend of mine who used to be an editor at the Fader, then at the New Yorker, and now does A&R for XL. And he was like, there's other ways of helping artists than through press. A lot of times people in press feel that they're maybe doing something that's more pure than people who are getting paid based on the success of a band. But I think I decided that if I went into artists who I truly loved separate from getting paid off them and actually believed that they should have their money come from creating music, I was like, that is a good... It's like that same desire to help people who I felt just needed a little boost in order to reach an audience, I think applies to management for me.
What do you think the purpose of cultural media is?
I don't know. It's, you know, when there is a...
I don't mean that to be like an obtusely vague question, but like, is it to help artists?
Well, I think it is for some people who work in it. I don't think as a whole thing. That's not why the Newhouse family bought... That's not why, like, Condé bought Pitchfork, was because the Newhouse family wanted to help artists. But I think that's why, like, the people who work there have that job. There's some of them, many of them. I think there's a lot of people who, like, believe that criticism is really important. Honestly, I was never like a good critic, and I had a hard time understanding the full value of that as an editor. And fortunately, I like worked with people who did, and they were able to be like, no, this is important. I would be like, oh yeah, no, you're right. You're right. Just do what you're going to do with that. And, I don't know I think I already said the word impotent once, but sometimes criticism can feel really impotent and non-effectual. Sometimes it can, but...
When you say non-effectual, what is the thing that it is affecting?
I do think that there is a place for writers... I don't want to say something annoying.
What's annoying?
To like try to justify the purpose of criticism or something.
I mean, I don't think anyone needs... Let me rephrase this. I don't think anyone who isn't a total fucking dumbass needs the criticism as an idea to be justified to them. However, I think the collapse of like traditional media really highlights that you had a whole bunch of different priorities in one basket, and now we're kind of seeing where a lot of these things reset.
Yeah, I think... I mean, this is something... A common thing that I thought for... I was aware that I was working inside of a media bubble for almost the entirety that I was working inside of it. That was never like an illusion that I had that this was a lifetime career in any sense of the word. I think that there's like... I'm not sure what I was going to say. Ask a question.
What's a time where that bubble popped for you?
Oh, yeah. There was a thing like at a place like Fader when I think me and I would say my like peers started to sort of inherit it from the people who were in charge before us, and we were able to sort of cover things that we weren't seeing covered elsewhere. At first, at a place like Fader, it was pop music. It was me writing about putting Lana Del Rey on the cover when like the basic last coverage that she'd gotten before that was like people shitting on her because she did a bad SNL performance, or people were still coming out of like ways of talking about pop music that was a little shitty. And so there was a lot of things that we did, the Lana Del Rey cover, the Zayn Malik cover, Charlie XCX, not to pat myself on the back, but all three things that I wrote, And also, so that was differentiating 100% from what Pitchfork was doing or what indie blogs were doing. Like, there were people who covered pop music and were indie blogs. There weren't necessarily people who were like, I don't know. God, who was on the other cover of the Lana Del Rey issue? Like PopCon or something. I don't know. It was like PopCon, Ty Dolla Sign, Lana Del Rey, someone else good. But it was like putting those people in conversation, putting Ariana Grande and Yeji in conversation was something that like felt like it had a value. And then sort of what happened was like that stopped being unique. You couldn't differentiate yourself from Pitchfork by covering rap music. You couldn't differentiate yourself by covering pop music. And like you couldn't differentiate yourself by covering certain weird, I don't know.
So how do they differentiate themselves now?
I don't think places do. I don't think that places that are for money differentiate themselves pretty much across the board. But I do think that there's like a next wave. Like if I was like, oh, when we kind of took over from whoever the previous guard, like when the people who are now 30 took over from the people who were 35, like now the people who are 25 or whatever, I think there is a hope for like a there is something that I think is existing in creative like blogging or media or criticism or editorial is happening in places that are just not always for-profit blogs. I think that I'm seeing like people experimenting with Discord or people experimenting with social media only, or even there's a lot of really good just straight up like track blogs that exist now from people who like are probably getting $500 a month from them, but it's enough to like sustain their hobby in a way that is, I think for like the artists who are featured, it's probably like really great to be featured on like Gray Estate or whatever.
I'd
alternative.
Kill for $500 a month.
Yeah.
Kill for it.
It's coming.
Anyway, thanks for coming.
Yeah, thank you
everyone,
so much.
Thank Duncan.
Thank you.
Poppies, you want to come up?
Cool. Hello. We're Poppies. Or two-thirds or half of Poppies. I don't think we've ever done this. Just the two of us. So.
Nope.
All right.
Thanks for playing some brand spanking new songs.
Industry standard 8. Yeah.
I don't know. But this song is on, this next one's on that. We never get to play it live because it's a little more stripped down.
Thank you.
This is another one from our last release.
From Bed Music.
Yes.
You have three more. Two, new, and one old. is our throwback song. Throwback.
This one we never get to play, actually. It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Because the recording is just you and me.
Thanks again.
Thank you.